So we have a zero tolerance for oil in the environment, and a release of oil is something that we take very seriously.
The state is working to determine how much oil has spilled into Cook Inlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a proposal to cut per-student funding and ramp up online education.
Virtual education will help beam great teachers across the state where it's difficult to recruit and retain.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
State regulators today announced an oil leak from a pipeline owned by Hillcorp in Cook Inlet was halted successfully. At this point, the state doesn't have its own estimate for how much oil was released into the inlet or what caused the leak. This is the latest in a string of incidents for Hillcorp, and the company is facing a wave of scrutiny from both regulators and environmental groups. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
At this point, no one knows what hit Hillcorp's Anna oil platform in Upper Cook Inlet on April 1st. All that's known is that workers felt an impact, then looked over the side of the platform to see every oil company's worst nightmare, an oil sheen on the water. The company thinks the leak came from an 8-inch pipeline which was at maximum capacity, carrying more than 19,000 gallons of crude oil. Hillcorp shut down the platform, and the day after the leak started, the company put what's called a pig through the oil line. This halted the leak and pushed the remaining crude into a holding tank. Hillcorp estimates less than 10 gallons was released. However, the state says it still needs to do some arithmetic.
We'll be looking at the volume of the line and the amount of oil they remove from the line and trying to determine what's missing.
That's Kristen Ryan, director of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Spill Prevention and Response. Ryan says the state hasn't observed any impacts to wildlife. But Ryan says the volume of oil released will factor into how the state penalizes Hillcorp for the incident.
We have a zero tolerance for oil in the environment, and a release of oil is something that we take very seriously. So it's, yes, I assume there'll be a penalty, which is a fine for this release.
Hillcorp is already dealing with another incident in Cook Inlet, a natural gas leak from a different pipeline, which started in December and is still ongoing. Divers have been unable to fix the gas leak for weeks due to dangerous ice conditions in Cook Inlet. After talks with Governor Bill Walker, Hillcorp recently agreed to shut down the oil platform associated with the leak over a month after it was first detected. While various pieces of equipment have been upgraded over the years, a lot of the oil and gas infrastructure in Cook Inlet is decades old. Much of it was first installed in the 1960s. Ryan says it's time for state regulators to take a holistic look at Cook Inlet's aging infrastructure.
Try to have a better record of what pipes are where, who owns them, how old are they, you know, what's their inspection frequency.
Over the next year, Ryan says the state will compile an updated report on the age and status of Cook Inlet's oil and gas operations. From there, she says, the state may decide to change its regulations. If Hillcorp is fined for the oil leak, it wouldn't be a first. Over the past year, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission fined Hillcorp multiple times for safety incidents. In March, the commission fined Hillcorp $200,000 for a 2015 incident on the North Slope that nearly resulted in the deaths of three workers. Hillcorp turned down requests for interviews on both the gas leak and the oil leak. To say the fines, the ongoing gas leak, and the oil leak have alarmed environmental groups would be an understatement. Among the many species that live in Cook Inlet, the body of water is home to a population of beluga whales, which are listed as endangered. This is Bob Shavelson of Cook Inlet Keeper, a group that's threatened to sue Hillcorp over the gas leak.
We've seen a toxic corporate culture here. We've seen a complete disregard for worker safety and environmental protection.
As the state takes a closer look at aging infrastructure in Cook Inlet, environmental groups are ramping up their scrutiny of all of Hillcorp's operations. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Alaska schools would see a $69 million cut in the amount of money the state provides based on the number of students each school district serves, called the base student allocation, under the budget proposed by the Senate Finance Committee today. The base student allocation would drop roughly $300 per student from the current level of just below $6,000. Bethel Democrat Lyman Hoffman says the cut to the base student allocation was needed to help close the gap between the amount the state government spends and the amount it raises.
We, as a state, are continuing to struggle with the fact that we are living beyond our means today.
This per-student allocation is the biggest piece of the more than $1 billion the state spends each year on schools. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says it's impossible to control state spending without considering the amount spent on the BSA.
It's huge when we go to look at any cuts, when you hold that large of a department harmless.
Senators also introduced three bills intended to reshape education with an emphasis on providing lessons online. The bills also would eliminate funding for the Alaska Performance Scholarships, which help Alaska students with high grades attend college in the state. Online education could help address a teacher shortage, according to Palmer Republican Senator Shelley Hughes, who says the state hasn't been able to retain teachers in many school districts.
Virtual education will help beam great teachers across the state where it's difficult to recruit and retain.
Leaders of the House majority didn't like the Senate proposal to cut the base student allocation. House Speaker Bryce Edgman notes the House didn't cut any of the base student allocation.
I think what concerns me is not only the cost that reduction incurs upon schools and smaller communities, but it's the notion that there could be an equal amount of reductions next year and then maybe the year after if you look at the Senate's overall plan of $750 million in cuts.
Edgman says he supports increasing faster internet connections in schools, but says nothing replaces having teachers in classrooms. The other education bill senators introduced today would fund school broadband connections so their speeds increase and would suspend a state mandate that school districts periodically review their curriculums. The Senate Education Committee is scheduled to discuss the bills tomorrow. Alaska State Troopers say a four-year-old girl who was buried by snow falling off a metal roof has died. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says authorities were notified by the state medical examiner today that the girl has passed away. The troopers say the girl is Alexia Burrill. Authorities say Alexia was buried by 5 feet of snow on Saturday. They were notified by a woman who said she could not find her granddaughter after snow slid off the roof. Alexia was found buried under the snow on the back porch of the home. Authorities have said the child had no pulse and was not breathing when she was found, but she was revived. She was flown from a Fairbanks hospital to Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a week of ski events comes to an end in Fairbanks.
I got quite a few World Cup points over the season and then finish off real strong here. So, I mean, I think I'm putting myself definitely as one of the big names up there for next year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
People in four Alaska communities are trying to get the highest level of protection available under federal law for water bodies important to them. Outstanding National Resource Water Protection, also known as Tier 3, shields waterways from any significant pollutants. But as KHNS's Emily Files reports, what happens with pending Tier 3 nominations is an open question.
The pending nominations are for the Chilkat River in Haines, the Coctuli River in Bristol Bay, the Yakutat Forelands, and the Chandalar River in Venati. Nothing can happen with these applications because the state is still deciding what process it should follow to evaluate them.
It's a complicated subject.
Michelle Hale is the director of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Water. She and her staff are going back to the drawing board in their quest to determine how to deal with Tier 3 nominations.
These are questions that we've tussled with.
Hale is speaking here on a teleconference set up to gather public input on this topic. She also facilitated meetings in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks, and has another scheduled in Dillingham.
We're really trying to get input from people who are interested in this topic to help us move forward with a Tier 3 designation process.
This isn't DEC's first stab at creating a Tier 3 evaluation procedure. Last year, the department decided Tier 3 nominations have such broad implications that the decisions should be left to the Alaska legislature. Governor Bill Walker introduced legislation to that effect.
That legislation itself generated a lot of questions and controversy.
Many people spoke out against it, saying the decisions would become politicized. So Governor Walker withdrew the bills. He said he wanted to incorporate more public input. That's the incentive behind the teleconference and meetings DEC held in March. Before we get into the feedback DEC heard during the teleconference, let's talk about what Tier 3 designations would actually do. The implications of Tier 3 protection help explain why it's been so difficult for the state to settle on a process. The Federal Clean Water Act requires states to have a procedure in place to evaluate outstanding water nominations. These protections go beyond what's currently available in Alaska. In most Alaska waters, discharges that degrade water quality are allowed, up to a point. But if a water body gets Tier 3 status, the restrictions get a lot tighter. Only short-term, temporary degradation is allowed.
The water quality at the time of designation has to stay the same, and that means that additional pollutants, for example, from a wastewater discharge stream, cannot be added to that water. And that creates a lot of the questions and a lot of the conflict that comes about from the whole Tier 3 water designation process.
There is already conflict in places like Haines, which would be impacted if tighter pollution restrictions were put on the Chilkat River. The Chilkat Indian Village of Klukwan applied for Tier 3 status. Village leaders say the protection would help secure the future of a vital salmon resource. But many people in Haines are upset about the nomination. They worry it could stymie economic growth by preventing development, including a potential mine that is in the exploration phase near the Chilkat River.
The process that we come up with needs to work well for all Alaskans and for all waters of the state, now and in the future.
The people on the teleconference weighed in on who should be allowed to nominate a Tier 3 water, what criteria should be used, and what the evaluation process should look like. One of the clearest messages those on the line conveyed was this.
We oppose legislative approval.
That's Werner Wilson from the Bristol Bay Native Association. He and others said they want DEC to make decisions on Tier 3 nominations, not the legislature. Hale said if Tier 3 decisions are left to DEC, it's unclear how to pay for it, especially since the department has downsized due to state budget cuts. Hale said right now there are still more questions than answers, but she hopes the public input DEC is gathering will provide a clearer direction. Anyone can learn more about the issue and contribute their own input on DEC's website. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
The death of Ketchikan Dr. Eric Garcia last week is now considered suspicious after police learned a friend who reported Garcia missing had allegedly stolen money and valuable items from Garcia's home. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Garcia was found dead in the upstairs living room area of his home on Summit Avenue on March 27th after his friend, 31-year-old Jordan Joplin of Maple Valley, Washington, called police to say Garcia hadn't been seen for 10 days. Police initially considered the death to be from natural causes, but as a matter of routine, sent the body to the state medical examiner's office for an autopsy. 4 days later, Ketchikan Police Department called local media in for a news conference. Deputy Police Chief Josh Dossett says police heard from family members who live in the lower 48 that Garcia had some valuable collections of coins, hard liquor, wine, and watches that were not found in his home. Dossett says police searched Dr. Garcia's vehicle and found evidence of a shipment of items sent by barge on March 17th.
The investigation showed Mr. Joplin shipping the items. Ketchikan Police Department contacted the shipping company and had the shipment stopped. Three officers responded to the Seattle area. Officers continued to work the investigation here in Ketchikan. Officers learned Mr. Joplin was withdrawing money from Dr. Garcia's account for a total of approximately $37,000.
When the shipping containers arrived in Washington, they were searched by King County Sheriff's, Port of Seattle Police, and Ketchikan Police.
Officers recovered a large amount of Dr. Garcia's property. An arrest warrant was issued for Mr. Joplin for theft in the first degree. Officers contacted Mr. Joplin just a short time ago as he attempted to pick up the property, and he chose not to speak with officers.
Joplin was arrested on the warrant and will need to be extradited to Ketchikan to face charges. Dossett says the time frame for that process depends on many factors, so he couldn't say when Joplin would be arraigned for the alleged theft. Dossett says the missing money has not yet been recovered. Police are still determining whether they found all the missing items. And then there's the death. Dossett says Garcia had last been seen at work around noon on March 16th. He had plans to attend a week-long out-of-town conference, so he wasn't expected back at his workplace. Dossett says the shipments and the electronic bank account transfers started March 17th, which is after Garcia is believed to have died. Dr. Garcia's autopsy results showed no obvious cause of death, so Dossett says a toxicology screening has been initiated.
Due to the nature of this case, they're actually speeding it up. We should have some results in 2 to 3 weeks. Normally it's a 6 to 8 week wait for toxicology.
So at this point, is the death being considered suspicious?
At this point, we would consider the death suspicious, yes.
Dossett says some Ketchikan officers are still in Washington searching Joplin's home in Maple Valley for additional evidence with the continued assistance of King County Sheriffs and Port of Seattle Police. Dr. Garcia was a general surgeon at Peace Health Ketchikan Medical Center for about 10 years. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
A fourth person has been charged in a December shooting that killed two Anchorage residents. State prosecutors say Savon Wiley is charged with counts of second-degree murder and robbery in the deaths of Christopher Brooks and Danielle Brooks at their Northeast Anchorage home. DeAnthony Harris, Jalen Franklin, and LaMarcus Mann also face murder and robbery charges. Police, just before 4 p.m. on December 24th, took a call reporting a man with gunshot wounds outside an apartment building. They found Christopher Brooks mortally wounded. Danielle Brooks was found dead inside. Online court records do not list Wiley's attorney. He's jailed with bail set at $250,000.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Preparations for wildfire season is underway. Alaska Fire Service spokeswoman Beth Ipson says smoke jumpers have been training and will commence practice jumps this week in the Fairbanks North Pole area. Something she says will go on despite this year's hefty snowpack.
They just land in the snow. And while it may be cold, it also offers maybe a little extra cushion.
Ipson says the group of AFS smoke jumpers includes seasoned veterans as well as some newbies.
We usually have anywhere from 5 to 10 rookies every year, and they come on a little bit later, and they'll go through more intense training before they actually go and do the jumps.
Ipson says the goal is to have jumpers ready to go mid-month, noting that they were deployed on their first wildfire of the season last year on April 19th, just a couple of days after completing their training. A week of high-level cross-country ski racing wrapped up in Fairbanks yesterday with the women's and men's marathons. As KYC's Dan Bross reports, the races, including three national championship events, showcase the nation's top Nordic skiers, including numerous Alaskans.
U.S. ski team star Jesse Diggins of Minnesota swept the individual races at the Birchill Recreation Area, capping the week by winning the women's 30-kilometer skate technique race Sunday.
She won the skiathlon on Monday, going away. She won the sprint race on Wednesday, and here she is, coming to win again for the number one Stratton Mountain skier, Jessica Diggins.
It was the end of a very long racing season, and Diggins, who ranked 6th in the world this year, says being back in the United States and racing among friends enabled her to muster a little extra energy.
And just focus on having fun instead of
putting pressure on myself, and then it was easier to go fast again, I think.
As she did throughout the races in Fairbanks, Diggins bested teammate Keegan Randall of Anchorage in Sunday's 30K. Randall is a former World Cup champion who is coming back strong after having a baby.
I didn't really have expectations, and overall I think it went really well, but it's amazing. I could feel almost every couple of weeks my body changing and getting slowly back to normal. So, I'm really excited to feel back to 100%.
Randall's home club, Alaska Pacific University, placed several athletes atop the standings over the week-long four-race series. On Sunday, Chelsea Holmes was third, Rosie Frankowski was fifth, and Becca Rorabaugh was 12th. Rorabaugh, who grew up in Fairbanks, says it was great to finish the season in her hometown, describing her pre-Olympic year as solid.
I think this was maybe one of the more consistent seasons I've had, but very few spectacular performances. So hoping to kind of get that high end going next year.
APU skiers also crowded the top in the men's 50-kilometer race. Scott Patterson of Anchorage broke away to take the top spot, just like he did in last week's opening day skiathlon. Patterson says he's feeling good about making the 2018 Olympic team.
I got quite a few World Cup points over the season and then finish off real strong here. So, I mean, I think I'm putting myself definitely as one of the big names up there for next year and make it happen next year.
Minnesota's Brian Gregg was second in Sunday's 50K. With the race season complete, Gregg says he's ready for a break, and that starts this week, leading a group of athletes to the North Slope village of Point Hope to teach skiing.
Work with the entire school and the entire community to come and ski, and yeah, it's a big party. We're basically skiing from 8 in the morning to 8 or 9 at night, and I love it.
Gregg was followed in yesterday's race by APU's Eric Packer of Anchorage, whose podium finish capped his return to racing after suffering a concussion in a January car accident.
Now that I'm finally allowed to race and come back here, I just really wanted to make it count. And it was a blast.
Another APU skier, Tyler Cornfield of Anchorage, was fourth in the men's 50K. Alaska will again be the venue for major ski races next year, with Anchorage scheduled to host pre-Olympic national championships in January. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Sitka is facing a tough balancing act between meeting their debt service on the Blue Lake Dam project and keeping rates reasonable for low-income Sitkans. Some are struggling to pay their electric bill. So the Sitka Assembly decided to implement a seasonal rate structure. Rates will be higher in the summer and lower in the winter, when keeping a house warm and well-lit can rack up a big bill. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Before we get into what the Assembly did, I want to talk about what they didn't do. The Assembly did not give final approval to a 15% electric rate increase that would have kicked in April 1st. Now, the city is under major deadline pressure to raise rates in Sitka. By July 1st, the annual bond payment for the Blue Lake Dam is due, but the city is far below what it needs to meet it. The finance department estimates the deficit somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million. Assemblymember Kevin Knox says defaulting on the payment or filing for bankruptcy is not an option.
That would be devastating here. We cannot, at this point, view that as an option.
So the city's solution is to charge customers more. Sitka's electric department calculated that a 15% rate hike would make up the difference. Their proposed ordinance also eliminates the tiered rate structure. So no matter how much energy a customer uses, they'd be charged the same rate. But three assembly members disapproved of the ordinance as written. Tristan Gavon was one of them, and here's why. In the past 2 years, the assembly has subsidized the electric fund with $3.5 million from the general fund to keep rates low for all. Gavon thinks that's unfair.
If I don't get a subsidy, it means I cut back on going out to dinner, or, you know, I don't take my vacation. I eliminate some of those wants. But some people don't have that flexibility.
He wants the assembly to hold off on raising rates until they can create a needs-based subsidy program for low-income Sitkans.
I think that's, you know, a value that's been really important to this community since time immemorial, holding one another up. And that's what I see this assistance program as.
So that was Gavon's sticking point, that the rate structure in Sitka is inequitable. And on the other side of the table, Assemblyman Aaron Bean thought the rates too high to begin with. He wants the Assembly to invite the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to perform an audit of the Energy Department and suggest a rate for Sitka.
If they hand down a rate, they ensure that it's reasonable, affordable, and not discriminatory in nature. You can't treat one user group different than the other.
Aaron Swanson also liked the idea of involving the state before raising rates again.
I think that we have raised our rates so high that people are starting to switch to alternative heating sources. And once they switch to those alternative heating sources, they're not switching back to electric.
Which is how Swanson, Bean, and Gavon all oppose the 15% rate hike on the principle of fairness, but with very different solutions for resolving it. When the time came to vote, they all said...
No.
No. No.
While Assemblyman Kevin Knox voted yes. Stephen Eisenbeiss and Bob Petruski, the other two members, were absent. And when his turn came, Mayor Matthew Hunter voted with the no majority, and in doing so, asked for the ordinance to be reconsidered at the Assembly's next meeting on April 11th, which means electric rates remain fixed in Sitka, at least for now. But the bond payment for the Blue Lake Dam will need to be paid somehow, and the clock is ticking. Here's Hunter.
If we don't pass this because of principle or because of other options we wish to look at that may take months to actually enforce, we're going to find ourselves with our hands tied, no money in the bank, and still having to raise rates anyway.
But the Assembly did pass something last night. Starting October 1st, Sitka's electric rates will change with the seasons. Residential customers will pay 19 cents per kilowatt hour in the summer and 12 cents per kilowatt hour in the winter. Small commercial users and boat slips qualify, while large commercial users and government facilities do not. Knox defended the measure as a chance to soften rates when temperatures are coldest and encourage people to stay with electric energy throughout the year rather than go to diesel or wood stoves.
It will discourage people from switching over to other alternatives, or at least the alternatives won't be as enticing.
This ordinance passed 4-1, with Bean voting against. But the first ordinance, that immediate rate hike, is in limbo for 2 weeks. Utility Director Brian Bertacci says this creates a bit of a problem.
Every 2 weeks delay between assembly meetings is about $75,000 to $100,000 that we're not collecting from the ratepayers, for better or for worse.
So let's say the ordinance doesn't pass and there's no rate increase at all this spring. The electric fund will be short yet again by $450,000 in FY18, Bertacci estimates. The hamster wheel that is the electric fund deficit could just continue unless the assembly does something soon. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Emily Files in Haines, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.